The UN Security Council votes on a Gaza resolution.
It took many days and many, many long nights of negotiating to get this right. But today, this council provided a glimmer of hope amongst a sea of unimaginable suffering.
Plus, drone strikes in Kyiv hit close to home for our reporter.
Our dog was scared by the sound of the explosion and hid in the bathroom shaking.
And later we look at Americans being detained overseas, the story of an award-winning journalist from Burkina Faso using the tools of her trade to serve her community. Today is Friday, December 22nd, and this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. After many delays, the UN Security Council adopted a watered-down resolution on Friday, calling for immediately speeding up aid deliveries to civilians in Gaza, but without the original call for an urgent suspension of hostilities between Israel and Hamas. The vote in the 15-member Security Council was 13-0, with the United States and Russia each abstaining. Linda Thomas-Greenfield is the U.S. ambassador to the U.N.
It took many days and many, many long nights of negotiating to get this right. But today, this council provided a glimmer of hope amongst a sea of unimaginable suffering. Today, this council called for urgent steps to immediately allow safe, unhindered, and expanded humanitarian access, and to create the conditions for a sustainable cessation of hostilities.
For the latest news on this developing story, please visit us online at voanews.com. And in other UN news, a new report warns more than 500,000 people are starving in Gaza as a result of the Israel-Hamas war. AP correspondent Ben Thomas has that story.
One in every four people is starving in Gaza as we speak.
The World Food Program's Arif Hussein blames the hunger on insufficient food shipments into the Gaza Strip.
It is a situation where pretty much everybody in Gaza is hungry.
And if the war continues at its current intensity, the population could face a full-fledged famine within the next 6 months. And he says it won't stop at hunger.
People are very, very close to large outbreaks of disease because their immune systems have become so weak because they don't have enough nourishment.
I'm Ben Thomas.
U.S. President Joe Biden is increasingly isolated on the world stage over his support for Israel's military campaign. At home, voters broadly disapprove of his handling of the strife. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wiedekuswara has that story.
20,000 people have been killed in Gaza since Israel began bombarding it 10 weeks ago, according to Palestinian officials. After days of intense negotiation to avoid a U.S. veto, on Friday, the United Nations Security Council is expected to vote on a resolution that will deliver more aid to Gaza. Israel is against the resolution's original provisions that call for the U.N. to take over inspection of aid trucks and immediate cessation of hostilities. U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Linda Thomas-Greenfield indicated her support for the current resolution text.
It's a resolution that will bring humanitarian assistance to those in need. It will support the priority that Egypt has in ensuring that we put a mechanism on the ground that will support humanitarian assistance.
As Israel continues its ground operation, President Joe Biden's unwillingness to call for a ceasefire has damaged ties with members of the American Muslim community who organized the Abandon Biden campaign. Abandon Biden organizer Jailani Hussein.
We are announcing that President Biden has lost the 2024 election. We are not powerless as American Muslims. We are powerful. We don't only have the money, but we have the actual votes.
National Security Council's John Kirby acknowledged the anger.
We're absolutely listening and trying to get a better understanding of all these different perspectives. That said, no nation should have to live with the threat that Hamas poses to Israel. No nation should have to live with that next door.
The majority of Americans, particularly young voters, disapprove of Biden's handling of the war, according to a New York Times poll. Aaron David Miller, senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for Peace, via Skype.
The poll numbers are shocking, frankly. An accelerated drift away from Biden, Arab Americans, progressives, voters of color, all of these groups are against what appears to be Biden's solid support for Israel. And that could, in a close election, take a toll. So I think the administration needs to tamp Gaza down, move toward reconstruction and humanitarian assistance, and then wrap the whole thing in a serious commitment to an end state.
The same poll shows that voters believe likely Republican nominee Donald Trump would do a better job of handling Gaza. Americans are split between those calling for a ceasefire and those who want Israel to win, even if more casualties mount, leaving Biden with political pressure from both sides. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News at the White House.
As we've heard, Joe Biden's support of Israel is costing him politically in the United States. In Israel, however, the war with Hamas is seen as an existential struggle and not simply a political spat. Elliot Cohen is a professor at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced and International Studies and a former counselor at the U.S. State Department under Condoleezza Rice.
The existential question reemerged in a very stark way, I think, on October 7th, because not only because Hamas is determined to destroy Israel, but because there's a larger context with other opponents who have the same objective, Hezbollah, the Houthis in Yemen, some of the militias in Syria, all of them backed by Iran, which has been very clear about its determination to destroy the Jewish state. The Israelis are now up against a set of opponents who intend to kind of grind it down by attrition and stretching it, and indeed eventually destroying it. So the very question of existence is absolutely on the table.
Well, the news came out early today that so far 20,000 Gazans have been killed. One could argue it's an existential crisis for them as well.
Well, that wouldn't be true for a number of reasons. First, you know, about those numbers there, the Hamas numbers. It's not clear whether Hamas is also counting numbers of operatives on their side who've been killed. It's also not clear that they distinguish between their own friendly fire casualties. Remember, something like about a quarter of the rockets fired out of Gaza land in Gaza. The numbers there, which are horrifying, are numbers, however, that result from a war that Hamas initiated and from a war that Israel had to fight. There's no way that Israel could not respond to the devastating attack of October 7th. The result is urban warfare. And, you know, one thing we need to remind ourselves is urban warfare is grim and bloody. So we're up against the realities of a war that Hamas brought upon the people of Gaza, not Israel.
Israel, in its reaction to what happened, the some would say heavy-handedness of its reaction, is further isolating itself on the world stage. Does that not create another existential crisis?
I have no idea what you mean by heavy-handed. You know, remember, it's very important when Americans think about what that October 7th attack was like. So for an attack on the United States to have been proportional to what Israel suffered on that day, remember, 1,200 people murdered, you know, large numbers of women raped, you know, all kinds of atrocities, you would be looking at something like about 36,000 dead in a single day. And no country on earth would do anything except other than act to destroy the people who launched that barbaric attack. As I said, this is a densely packed area with which is run by a movement that actually likes to have the civilians out front and taking casualties. As you know, in terms of alienating the rest of the world, well, I'm not so sure. I mean, the Israelis have never been particularly popular. It's very significant, though, that by and large European governments have been supportive, the American government has been supportive, and interestingly enough, none of the Arab countries with which Israel has diplomatic relations have broken those relations. And in fact, they are quietly supportive because they understand the nature of the threat that's posed by Hamas.
So what happens next? In your essay, you say a prolonged and not unhealthy soul searching awaits a country once again under siege. What will Israel find in that soul searching?
Well, nobody can yet tell. I mean, this is I was just there for on a study trip, and one of my interlocutors, who is a very experienced Israeli official, said, you know, after every earthquake, there are aftershocks. And the aftershocks can go on for years in this case, and they'll have many dimensions. I think there'll be a domestic political dimension. There may even be a dimension in terms of Israel's relationship with Palestinians, both in Gaza and on the West Bank. But I think that the main thing is this is a watershed, not just for Israel, but in the history of the Middle East and for the Palestinians. You know, one of the things that's quite interesting, there's been polling done by Khalil Shikaki, who's a Palestinian pollster who's respected by everybody, which indicates that support for Hamas has been falling in Gaza. And that's not entirely surprising, because I think the people of Gaza know exactly who brought this upon them, and it is Hamas.
Elliot Cohen is a professor at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. He holds the Ashley Burke Chair in Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Professor Cohen, thanks for your time today.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. We'll get an update on U.S. government plans to help families of Americans held hostage or wrongly imprisoned around the world in a moment. First, though, an update from Kyiv, where the defense ministry was forced to clarify what the defense minister meant when he announced that Ukrainian men living abroad would be compelled to join the armed forces. And an overnight drone attack in Kyiv hits close to home. VOA correspondent Anna Chernikova was near the area where the debris fell, and she has the details.
Russian forces launched a massive drone attack on Ukraine late on Thursday, targeting Kyiv as well as central, southern, and western regions. In fact, one of the drones passed by my own apartment building at around midnight. It sounded like an old motorbike flying through the air and seemed very close, as the sound was very loud at first and quieter as the drone passed. It was followed by the powerful sound of an explosion nearby. My family and I went to the shelter when we heard the sound of the drone approaching. We moved the child to the shelter in the first place, while our dog was scared by the sound of the explosion and hid in the bathroom shaking. Afterward, Kyiv officials confirmed crashing debris in the neighborhood, approximately 5 kilometers from my home. In total, drone debris hit three districts in Kyiv, damaging two residential buildings and injuring two civilians. The drones were launched from inside Russia and occupied Crimea. There is still controversy surrounding military conscription. On Wednesday, the German media outlet Welt reported that Ukrainian Minister of Defense Rustem Umerov said that next year Ukrainian men aged 25 to 60 living abroad would be ordered to appear at conscription points or recruitment centers to join the armed forces of Ukraine. Otherwise, sanctions will be applied to them. This is widely seen as unconstitutional, and the idea caused a lot of controversy both inside and outside of Ukraine. The Ministry of Defense of Ukraine clarified that Minister Umerov meant that all men living abroad would be invited to join the armed forces, but not compelled to do so, as there is no legal mechanism currently in place for that. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
Also in Ukraine, about 500 houses of worship have been destroyed or damaged since the 2022 Russian invasion, according to the American Institute for Religious Freedom. A Ukrainian group called Temples Under Fire is making expeditions to the front lines to document damage to the spiritual and historical heritage of the country. Laisa Bakletz met with the project's participants in Kyiv and filed this report.
This church in the Kyiv region was damaged by Russian shelling in the first days of the full-scale invasion 22 months ago.
Так як дуже багато осколків, то воно тут було таке, ну, все дуже жахливо.
Микола Мединський, a chaplain, says you can see how destroyed the building nearby is. The church had a surreal look: debris, a fallen cross. Мединський has served in the Ukrainian army since 2014. When Russia's full-scale invasion began, he joined the Temples Under Fire project. Activists document shrines destroyed as a result of Russian aggression.
Ми створили цифрову платформу, на якій ми збираємо.
Ірина Лисенко, project manager Temples Under Fire, says the group created a digital platform where they collect photos and video materials of destroyed temples. She says they collect materials from the frontline areas where the fierce battles took place. Already, she says, they have 20 video clips. The majority of destroyed places of worship are in the eastern Donetsk and Lugansk regions. Some of the churches cannot be rebuilt.
В Руських Тишках була повністю зруйнована дерев'яна церква 18-го століття.
Ірина Лисенко says there was a wooden church from the 18th century in the Kharkiv region. It was specially constructed and could be moved from one village to another, the so-called travel church. It worked for three centuries, she says, but Russia destroyed it completely. Ukrainian Orthodox churches were not the only houses of worship destroyed, says religious scholar Людмила Филипович. Филипович says Greek Catholic churches and Protestant ones, many prayer houses have been destroyed, as well as synagogues and mosques. She says today in Ukraine, all religious organizations are suffering from Russian aggression. Religious scholar Людмила Филипович presented the materials gathered by activists of Temples Under Fire at the Conference of European Churches seeking support and legal advice.
Вони дуже активні в своїх
Филипович says they are very active in their cooperation with the Brussels European Parliament and the Strasbourg Court. They plan to offer us not only informational support, but also legal support, she says, how to record these crimes properly so we can present them in court. Activists say they hope their videos will provide good evidence at future proceedings in international courts against Russia. They also believe their work will facilitate the search for donors who will help rebuild the churches. Леся Бакалець, VOA News, Kyiv.
Loved ones of Americans imprisoned overseas have a small reason to celebrate this holiday season. The U.S. Congress passed an annual spending measure to fund the Defense Department, including special considerations for Americans wrongly detained. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has the story.
In a rare show of bipartisan support, the U.S. Congress passed the $886 billion National Defense Authorization Act, also known as the NDAA. The act appropriates Defense Department funding for the coming year. This year, it also contains provisions to assist family members of U.S. hostages, such as those recently released by Iran. The NDAA offers assistance for travel to Washington for families to advocate on behalf of their missing loved ones. It also allows the State Department to connect families with services from legal to mental health while they work to broker their relatives' safe release. Director of the Journalism Protection Initiative at the Craig Newmark Graduate School of Journalism, Joel Simon, in an interview with VOA.
When you think about hostage taking and kidnapping, the groups that engage in this practice are obviously in a kind of deeply adversarial relationship with whoever the negotiating partner is. So it's always complicated to find some interlocutor who can bridge that gap. But the reality is that hostage crises are resolved through negotiation. So if you're going to reach a resolution, you need that kind of interlocutor.
In the case of hostages taken from Israel and released as part of a prisoner swap with Hamas and its allies, the United States, Egypt, and Qatar brokered the deal. While a positive outcome for those families, more than 110 hostages from Israel remain missing. Then there's Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty journalist Alsu Kurmasheva. She works for an agency that, like Voice of America, is fully funded by the U.S. government. Russia imprisoned her on the charge of failing to register as a foreign agent. Under a Russian law passed in 2012, any person or group receiving funding from abroad must register if they engage in political activity. Kurmasheva's husband and current Time journalist Pavel Buturin speaking with VOA.
I'm convinced that Alsu is being targeted because she's an American citizen and because she is a journalist for Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. She is held in a cold prison cell exactly for that reason.
In the case of Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich, whom Moscow charged with espionage in March, there has so far been little movement. Gershkovich, the journal, and the U.S. government deny the charges against him, but there's not much to be done without some sort of diplomacy. The United States gave Gershkovich the technical designation of wrongfully detained. Joel Simon, once again speaking with VOA.
You're basically on your own until you're designated as someone who's unlawfully detained. You might have some kind of nominal support from the State Department. You might have you're going to have consular support, but you're not going to have the full engagement of the State Department or the National Security Council or right up to the president without that designation. So, you know, it's absolutely critical.
Here in Washington's Georgetown neighborhood, a temporary mural dedicated to Americans wrongfully detained recently came down. Some of the prisoners were released while others remain in foreign custody. A new, more permanent mural is in the works for sometime next year. The NDAA designates March 9th as U.S. Hostage and Wrongful Detainee Day with an official flag to commemorate the occasion. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
And finally today, how one woman is tackling the crisis of misinformation and lack of information in her community. Racked by conflict and unrest, Burkina Faso is a tough environment for journalists, with issues like rape and sexual violence often taboo. But Miriam Ouedraogo is pushing back to provide a platform through her reporting for those affected by unrest. While in Washington to receive an award, she spoke with VOA's Salem Solomon about her career.
Based in the bustling capital of Burkina Faso, Mariam Ouedraogo is focused on her reporting for the French daily Citoyen. The Burkinabe journalist has built a career out of shedding light on oft-overlooked social issues that affect her community. In her coverage of education, health, and insecurity, she looks to how women, children, and people with disabilities are affected. Her drive, a desire to make a difference through journalism. She says she wanted to change things and that she was looking for a job that would allow her to leave more impact on social facts and subjects in her surroundings. It's an approach that has earned the reporter national and international recognition, including a Knight Award presented in Washington in the fall. Each award, says Ouedraogo, is an opportunity to amplify the voices of those she reports on, including survivors of conflict and rape. Ouedraogo also broke new ground when honored with the Bayou Calvados Normandy Award for war correspondents, the first African woman to win that award. Militant attacks in Ouedraogo's home country are increasing. The Africa Center for Strategic Studies, a research center focused on security, estimates that around 8,600 people will die due to extremist attacks by the end of this year, more than double the total last year. Instability in Burkina Faso drives a lot of Ouedraogo's reporting. She says the stories collected from survivors of rape, which extremists often use as a weapon, weigh heavy. She says the women face unimaginable suffering. The simple fact that someone is sexually assaulted has also impacted her, she says. She says it's traumatic and she calls it another death. Describing her process of collecting these accounts as testimony, Ouedraogo encourages more women to become journalists, saying women bring unique perspectives to marginalized communities and emphasizing the potential of journalism to affect positive change. Salem Solomon, VOA News.
And that's going to end today's show. There is more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until next week, I'm Steve Karish.
Stay up to date with VOA Podcasts. Each weekday, International Edition covers the world's biggest stories while Flashpoint Iran and Flashpoint Ukraine examine their respective regions in depth every week.